Well, I got the idea that a lot of people would enjoy hearing a large number of different ident signals. Because, of course, if you're a DXer, a lot of these ident signals, you can hear them, but you don't really know what they are or where they're coming from. So I decided to put a series together, and we had about 100. A couple over 100 of these ident signals and interval signals and ident announcements. And of course, a lot of them are in foreign languages. And a lot of DXers, if they only speak English, they're not going to understand a Russian ident announcement or any other language. So I figured this is a good way to get people familiar with an ident signal. And once they've heard it, on the program, they can put it away in their memory, or they can tape it themselves at home, and then they could identify the station if they ever came across it on the shortwave bands. And it was a very popular series, and it ran for a number of months because I only ran about maybe two or three a week on the program, so it lasted quite a while.
Now, when you were putting it together, how did you compile the material for it? You didn't sit by a radio yourself and record stuff, right?
No, some of them I got our monitoring station in Stittsville, that's RCI's monitoring station in Stittsville, to record quite a few of them. The others I got directly from the stations involved. Radio Moscow supplied quite a few, and the BBC and a number of other stations, so we got good, clear signal on those. It wasn't all full of static and fading, so it gave people a good idea of what it sounded like.
Do you remember some of the most unusual stations?
Well, there were a few of the regional USSR stations that I got, because Radio Moscow gave me quite a grab bag of different station identification signals, and a lot of these you couldn't get off shortwave because they were so hard to hear, at least in North America they were. So this was a great help, and that Soviet part of the series ran to quite a few. There were probably about 15 different idents from the USSR at that time.
Here in Asia, there are some very unusual ones that I can pick up. The most interesting ones seem to be coming from, like, the Philippines, where they have, I don't know why they're doing this, but they put so much reverb on the interval signals that it sounds like the person is in an echo chamber in a recording studio. It's very funny. And also, of course, the ones from the DPRK in North Korea.
Yeah. Well, a lot of those are just bad recordings to begin with, I guess. And there's nothing you can do to get around that. And of course, it's further aggravated or degraded by the fact that you're hearing it on short wave. So unless it's a really good recording to begin with, what you're going to get, say in North America from Asia, is not going to sound all that good. And that was the advantage that this series had. You got a good, clear signal on these idents.
Well, let's move to today, because you did the first series one, a few years ago. How was this something that you had wanted to do for a long time, or was it Colin's idea?
No, I had the idea. It was just the fact that I ran it in the mid-1970s on the program, and then subsequently I put them on cassette tapes, and they were sold by the Handicapped Aid Program to raise funds for that program. And that, of course, about 15 or 20 years later, I thought to myself, well, there are going to be a lot of new shortwave listeners that might be interested in this ident series. So Colin and I decided to put it out on a CD, and it sold quite a few copies. Between that series and the second CD set that we put out, we raised about $2,000, and these sales are a fundraising a means of fundraising for the food bank in Duncan, British Columbia that I volunteer with. So it raised quite a bit of money for the food bank.
Right. Colin, let's move to you for a moment. I mean, what was it like putting together this series? And can you give me a little bit of your background as a shortwave listener?
Certainly, I've been a broadcast listener and shortwave listener since about 1971 or 72. I was, in fact, a very young fan of Ian McFarland in the mid 70s, and was a regular on one of his regular listen to one of his shows. So I probably heard the interval signal series when it first came out in the mid to late 70s. I actually have some original cassette recordings of those. Of course, 25, 35 years ago, they're, old and kind of scratchy cassette tapes. So I now had the original reel-to-reel tape of the interval signals, fresh from the studio to use as remastering material for the CD. So it was quite a blast from the past to have these reels of tape in my hand and put some pretty solid copies onto CD. The bulk of the email I've had from a lot of people that were buying the CDs were saying the same thing. It's like we're hearing this shortwave material and these interval signals like we've never heard them before, and it feels so good to go back in time for a moment, back in the shortwave heyday of the mid 70s.
Well, I should add at this point, Keith, that I've always been a bit of a pack rat. So when I retired from RCI in 1991, I still had all of the tapes from the major series that I ran on the program over the years. I had the ident signal on the original tapes that I used on the air. And also another popular series that I ran on the air was the language recognition course. And that was part of the second set of CDs that we put out. So between one thing and another, we've got a lot of archive material to put onto CDs that will be a bit of nostalgia for my listeners from the 70s onwards, and also something which will be relatively fresh for anybody who's only been listening for the last 10 years or so, because I haven't been on the air since, I guess, 1993.
Well, Ian, it's funny that you mentioned that you're a pack rat because I pretty much do the same thing. I have recordings that I made of off air going back to the early 80s. And I just remembered something that I had sitting in a box, which has not been unpacked for more than 15 years, which I will send your way because you will find it amusing. Because in the early 90s, when RCI suffered a severe cutback at CKUT, where I was in Montreal, I don't remember who it was. I think it was somebody from the technical department. They said, "Oh, we have some tapes that we're getting rid of. Do you want to recycle them?" And I went, "Okay, sure, I'll take them." Anyway, I was going through the box and found some interesting programs from like Bob Cadman and everything, which I decided to keep for myself. And inside were two 10-inch reels of some interval signals.
That's strange. I thought I was the only one that had the originals of those. Maybe there were a few other copies floating around, but
Which
that's
I, which
news to
I.
me.
Which I still have, and the tape has become very brittle, but I will definitely send it along your way.
Well, there may be a little more life in the old ident and interval signals series yet.
Because some of the stuff we have is actually, it's labeled master copy, do not discard or whatever, and some of them are obviously our copies.
So, when you were putting this material together, how did you decide what to put in? I mean, obviously, there's so much. You didn't include everything, did you?
No, that's a virtually impossible task. I wrote to virtually every shortwave station in the world, and of course, a lot of them replied, but a lot of them didn't. So the ones who didn't weren't included in the series, unless we were able to record it through Stittsville, our receiving station near Ottawa. So it was the ones that were left out were not left out intentionally. It's just that we didn't record those at Stittsville, or the station in question didn't reply to our request.
Well, now you have series three ready. And if this one is titled Then and Now, tell me a bit about that.
Well, the basis of this particular CD series is a joint program that I did back in the mid 70s, I guess, or the mid 80s. I can't remember now. I've got a very bad memory for dates. But it was a program, a joint program that Bob Zanotti and I did. Bob Zanotti, of course, was with Swiss Radio International. And we took every opportunity to do joint programs. And we did quite a few of them. And this particular joint program, and the date occurs to me now, was 1989, which a lot of listeners will remember was the year that the Berlin Wall came tumbling down, the end of communism. Well, we did a joint program. We were both attending an international broadcasting conference in West Berlin at that time. There was still a West and an East Berlin in 1989. And we recorded that and did a joint program. Some of it was on Swiss Radio International, and the other was on Radio Canada International. So I still had the original tapes from that. So that is what is on the new CD series. And we also did an update on that because, of course, that's 20 years ago now, and an awful lot has changed in the last 20 years in the world of shortwave broadcasting. So we did an updated look at what's happened in the last 20 years to international broadcasting on shortwave. And taking part in that was Kim Andrew Elliott of the Voice of America. He used to be the host and producer of Communications World. He's now working as an audience research officer at the IBB, the International Board of Broadcasting. And also John Figliozzi, an American who is a very prolific writer on the subject of shortwave and a very avid shortwave listener. And, of course, there was Bob Zanotti involved as well, and I, and Colin Newell.
And Jeff White from Radio Miami International.
That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so we had a roundtable discussion to try and analyze just what has happened in the world of shortwave broadcasting over the last 20 years. Because, of course, back in 1989, it was nothing but good news as far as shortwave broadcasting was concerned. And everything was gung-ho. But, of course, a lot has come down the road since 1989 in that branch of broadcasting. And a lot of stations that were on the air back then are no longer with us.
Mm-hmm. There's one of the companies that is supplying me with two radios to give away, Sanjen, which you definitely know. I was talking to their sales manager, and he said, after the first Gulf War in the early 90s, he said, because of the CNN coverage, he said they saw a drop in sales of shortwave radios. He said satellite television has had a really big impact.
Yeah, that often happens, but the reverse also happens. And in the time of international crises, there is a big increase in international broadcast listening because that's mm-hmm. virtually, at one point, was the only way you'd get any news was to hear it on shortwave. But, of course, 24-hour news stations like CNN, which also has a European branch, they're covering the news 24 hours a day. So, really, these days, you don't have to listen on shortwave as much.
Yeah. Well, you know, Colin and Ian, there was something funny that I had a discussion with somebody about this a few months ago. I don't know if you remember, but I think it was around 2006. Taiwan, which sits on a very active earthquake zone, was hit by an earthquake just off the coast of Taiwan. And there was an underwater cable that carried a lot of internet traffic because Taiwan is one of the third major international hubs for the internet. And I was talking to somebody, and they said, well, what do you listen to on radio? I said, well, I listen to a lot of shortwave radio. And they said, oh, you don't have to listen to shortwave. You can get it all online. And I said, well, that's good. But for a period of 2 months, I couldn't listen to anything because the cable, the fiber optic cable just off the coast of Taiwan was snapped.
That's one of the main reasons why shortwave should continue, because at times like that, or whenever a country decides to shut down their internet connection, there goes your shortwave listening, unless you've got a shortwave receiver.
Right. Well, I don't know if you heard the news recently, but because of the political situation in Fiji, Radio Australia was taken off their domestic FM relay. And they just announced, I think it was maybe last week or the week before that, that they were adding two more shortwave frequencies for Fiji.
Yes. Yeah, it was basically, it came down to flipping a switch and cutting off an internet feed. And there was the BBC and Radio Australia and one or two other international broadcasters are carried on the main station in Suva. And they quite literally, somebody went in, a couple of mouse clicks, and that was it. It was cut off. Right. So, of course, the international broadcaster ABC has compensated by adding some programming time to Australia to fix the problem.
Yeah. Well, you know, Ian, when you were working on this series, was there part of you that was feeling very nostalgic?
Well, it was a very long process. It probably took about 6 months to put that series together. And I really feel more nostalgic now than I did at that point because so many of these ident signals no longer exist because the stations have gone off the air. I mean, just take Swiss Radio International, for instance. They're no longer in existence. A lot of what Radio Austria used to put on the air is gone now, especially their North American service. So many European stations have ceased broadcasting to North America. The only way you can get it is via the internet. And there's one story that I've told many, many times, which illustrates the great value of shortwave. Somebody I know was in Beijing at the time of the Tiananmen Square incident. And he was in a hotel not far from Tiananmen Square, and he was having trouble sleeping about 2 o'clock in the morning. And he could hear gunfire off in the distance. And he, of course, didn't have a clue what was happening. So he just flipped on his shortwave radio and tuned into the BBC and discovered right then and there via shortwave exactly what was happening about 4 blocks from his hotel room. Right. But he wouldn't have found out any other way.
You know, Jeff White was telling me a funny story. He said a few years ago when the Voice of America dropped Portuguese to Brazil because they'd signed an agreement with a local Brazilian broadcaster to have their signal relayed on FM and AM. He said the year before they stopped their shortwave, they had a contest to win just a shortwave radio, and they literally got thousands of people writing in. So for the launch of their domestic relay, the first prize was a 1 week trip to Washington, all expenses paid. And he said the VOA was kind of shocked because they received only two letters.
Yes, there are shocks like that. I can remember a similar shock. I had a program called Canada a la carte at one point.
I remember that.
On RCI. And it was a magazine program. We covered a great variety of topics. And I had in my mind stamp collecting is one of the world's most popular hobbies. So I figured, and we had a stamp corner feature on the program talking about different issues of Canadian stamps because many, many years ago, Canadian stamps were amongst the most dull stamps in the world. And Canada Post finally got the idea that they should zap up their stamps a little bit. So I ran a contest on the Canada a la carte program, and I offered full sheets of a number of different Canadian stamps, very nice Canadian stamps. So I ran this contest on the program over a four-week period, and I had one letter as an entry to the contest. And you know who the letter was from?
No.
It was from Jeff White. when he was just a plain, ordinary listener. I first met Jeff in 1974 when he was involved with a shortwave listening club in Chicago and invited me to be a guest speaker one year at their annual convention. But I can remember Jeff said in his letter, "Here's my entry. At least you've had one entry in the contest." And as it turned out, his entry was the only one I had in the contest. So from then on, I didn't consider that stamp collecting was one of the world's most popular hobbies, at least not with my listeners anyway.
Right. Well, you know, the thing that still amazes me about shortwave is since I revived the Happy Station show, what I am amazed about is, I mean, 9955 kilohertz from WRMI is not what you would call a high power transmitter that, say, like Radio Netherlands would have or other broadcasters, but I'm surprised that I've had people in Europe that can actually pick it up.
Well, it's quite amazing what happens to shortwave signals, because I know, I was always extremely fortunate at RCI because I had a very good relationship with the engineering department, and I knew exactly what was happening with the transmitters and the antennas, and I was aware that off the back of the antenna you get quite a number of megawatts going in the opposite direction to the front of the antenna. So I knew exactly which target areas were covered by any given transmission. And it's certainly on the African service. It wasn't just Africa that was getting the signal. It was the west coast of Canada and the USA. It was Europe. It was a whole bunch of different parts of the world, even the South Pacific. I can remember our 2130 African service transmission late in the day in Montreal got into the South Pacific area extremely well, because the reception reports that we used to get from our monitor in that part of the world, Arthur Cushion, the late Arthur Cushion, were always very good. And so I was able to put whatever programs I wanted to put on any given transmission on the weekend programs, which I was the producer of, virtually all of the weekend feature programs at one point. So I would put them, the Shortwave Listener's Digest, into the 2130 African service, because I knew it was going to get to five or six different disparate parts of the world. So I would get maximum coverage. So that was an advantage I was always very happy to have.
Do you think the time will come when stations will start making comebacks? Because we've seen some shortwave stations add frequencies when maybe just a few years ago they were dropping them like flies, but now they're adding a few more here and there. Do you see that happening more often?
Well, I don't know, but it's the old story, what goes around comes around, and every so often there is a new golden age of radio. Certainly on domestic radio in Canada here, every so often you have a new golden age of radio. And I can't see that this can't happen in the world of international broadcasting on shortwave, because I think, as a lot of people think, a lot of stations, I know Bob Zanotti was very hot on this with Swiss Radio International, they're just putting too many eggs in the internet basket. Because there are an awful lot of parts of the world that don't have access to the internet. And in some parts of the world, in Europe, for instance, you have to use a dial-up connection. And that, of course, precludes you using your telephone if you have a dial-up connection. So, and it's also very expensive, because in Europe, they pay by the minute. Not like in North America, you just pay a lump sum every month, and you can get an unlimited number of local calls. Your long distance is extra, of course, but if you have a dial-up connection, it certainly cramps your style quite a bit. So I can see that perhaps in another 5 years or 10 years, who knows, that there may be a resurgence in the interest in international broadcasting on shortwave on the part of the station. But of course,
you know,
a lot of the stations have gone off the air completely, like Swiss Radio International. So they really can't come back on shortwave because they've done away with all their transmitters.
You know, I was reading an interesting story this week. There's some big discussions going on at Radio France International right now, because they want to remove some language services and have them only on the internet for live streaming. And one of them I thought was just, I don't know where they're coming from, but they want to take their Chinese service, put it only on the internet. But then I was like, wait a second, I lived in Beijing for 8 years, and I know the website for Radio France International is blocked, so who is going to listen?
That's a very good question.
Exactly.
And, you know, I mean, when I was in Beijing, I remember a few times even trying to listen to the, you can access, now you can access the BBC website, but for the audio content for BBC World Service, you still can't access it. But yet on the BBC World Service site, they mentioned that they're doing a special podcast for China. And every time that I clicked on it, oh, it is unavailable. It is unavailable. It is unavailable. So I'm like, wait a second. Who are they targeting this to?
Well, it's the old story of the gatekeeper. You know, the gatekeeper has the key to the gate, and if he doesn't wish anybody to go through that gate, and this, of course, is the internet gate, they just lock it, and that's that. No, mm-hmm. There's nothing anybody can do about it.
Right. Okay, so finally, this series number 3, Then and Now, 20 Years of Shortwave Broadcasting, where can it be purchased from?
Well, the easiest way to get it is via the DXer.ca website. It would take a lot of explaining how to buy it otherwise, so what we've decided to do really is publicize the DXer.ca website, and all the details are there. It's just a matter of one or two or three clicks, and especially if you want to pay via PayPal, it's very easy to do. You just click, 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 and you're done.
And how much is the new series, Colin?
We're thinking about pricing it pretty much as the last one, about $12 US, so the equivalent, something similar in Canadian, and something equivalent in euros. We're having an additional thought about having it available for download, but we're talking about 3 hours worth of material. So if we want a fairly high quality download, we're talking lots and lots of megabytes. We had another thought as well, looking at selling the material on a reusable flash disk, if we can get a quantity of flash disk, because now you can buy, we've got 4 gigabytes of material here in high quality WAV or MP3 file. If we can squeeze them onto an inexpensive flash disk, we can, or flash drive, we'll market them that as an option, and that'll give something commemorative to people that they can repurpose.